From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack. Our connection this hour was made on February 19th when a 25-year-old woman published an open letter to her company's CEO. Talia Ben-Ora, who goes by Talia Jane, is a millennial who worked at Yelp in San Francisco. Frustrated by her low salary, the high cost of her rent, her long, expensive commute to work, and having to work in customer support for at least a year, she wrote the letter to Yelp's Jeremy Stoppelman and posted it on the website Medium.com. Needless to say, the letter went viral, and readers had mixed reactions, ranging from outrage to praise. Talia was fired from Yelp the same day she published the letter, but she updated the post with that news and included a link to her PayPal, Venmo, and Square Cash accounts, asking for donations. Now, even if you haven't read the letter, you may have some thoughts about one of the major discussions that have resulted from it, perceptions of millennials. Generation Y, with birth years between the early 1980s and the early 2000s, has a reputation that ranges from self-absorbed, entitled, and lazy, to confident, ambitious, and tech-savvy. So what do you think? Do millennials like Talia Jane deserve the criticism, or are they victims of carrying massive college loan debt into a tightening job market? We'll explore that question and the stereotypes surrounding millennials this hour with my guests, who are all millennials, here in studio today. Bianca Bishop is a case manager at Rochester Mental Health Center and a graduate student at Roberts Wesleyan College. Thanks for coming in, Bianca.
Thank you for having me.
Ben Eskind is the owner and operator of Pachamama Farm and a graduate student at the University of Rochester. Thanks for coming in.
Glad to be here.
Jen Everdyke is a student at the Rochester Institute of Technology. Thanks, Jen, for taking the time.
Thank you.
And Chuck Wade is a vice president and financial advisor at Brighton Securities. Thanks, Chuck.
Thanks for having me, Megan.
Now, if you haven't read Talia's letter, I've posted a link to it on our connections page at wxxinews.org/connections. But you don't need to have had read the letter to join our conversation today. You can call 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, you can call 263-WXXI. That's 263-9994. I'm also on Twitter at mmacmedia. Or you can email the program at connections@wxxi.org. We want to hear from you. But let's start off by going around the table. I would like to hear from each of you about what your initial gut reactions were when you read that letter. I'll start with Jen.
Well, I'm currently in school, as you mentioned, and I felt a little affronted just that she would assume that people should give her money for putting herself in a situation where she was in debt. I currently have, I think, 18 credits on my course load, and I'm also working approximately 25 hours a week and on weekends, which is something that she complained about in her letter. And I do that so I can pay my bills and so I don't have to be in debt. I know that my parents really enforced budgeting and making sure that you are aware of, you know, how much you're taking in and how much you can afford to spend on certain stuff before you ever commit to a lease or anything else of that magnitude. So that was my initial reaction.
Mm-hmm. Bianca?
Mine is similar to Jen's view, and I was just upset with her, the way she was complaining that she had to work for a year at her first job before she could move up. I don't think anyone really expects to get their dream job upon leaving college. I know I didn't, and I'm still working toward that goal. And even just a year before you can move up, that's not a very long time when you're working. I mean, might feel that long if you don't love it, but she was already in the company that she, like, wanted to work for, and, like, they could get her into a position that she would like. She just had to continue toward that first initial step.
Mm-hmm. Ben, would you like to weigh in?
Sure. Yeah, I felt badly for her initially, and, you know, it's sort of a sad letter. It's sort of facetious. It's a legitimate complaint in a way, voiced in a wrong way. So it was dumb, essentially, and bound to get her fired. But at the same time, understandable, like, what she's talking about.
So was it the tone that bothered you, or the public shaming? What was the turning point for you that changed your mind?
Well, I think it's a shame that she decided to kind of act on this, on her situation and how badly she was feeling in this fashion, rather than, you know, seeking better alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the tone for a second before we ask Chuck what he thought. Because if you haven't read the letter, it's a little snarky. Would you all agree? A little snarky?
Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
How else would you describe it for someone who hasn't read it?
She was just wallowing in self-pity for herself and was just naming like all these things that were going wrong in her life as if she has nothing going for her.
Mm-hmm. It's also highly critical. She rips into the, corporate climate at Yelp and the massive inequalities in this country and lamenting the disparities between, her CEO making hundreds of millions of dollars and her being stuck in, one of the most expensive cities in the world, or at least feeling stuck in this extremely expensive city with no money and dashed ambitions. So the typical stereotypical apathy that people talk about in terms of millennials. So it's kind of like this, that's how I took the tone, this mixed criticism, self-pity, self-effacing.
Well, the first line is, when I was a kid back in the 90s, when Spice Girls and owning a pager were hashtag goals. So to me, that doesn't start out as a very mature professional letter, but maybe that was not the intent. So we can talk about more about that in a second. But Chuck, what was your gut reaction upon reading the letter?
I thought I could genuinely see in her letter some legitimate concerns and the feeling that knowing that what you take in is not enough to pay for what you have to then send out. And knowing that feeling and the fear and the anxiety that probably brings up, I genuinely felt for her. On the other hand, I felt Abraham Lincoln used to write a letter if he was upset with somebody. He would write them a letter and he would put it in his desk. He wouldn't send it. And then it would take a day later, he would pull the letter back out and decide if he still thought it was a good idea to send it. I really think she probably should have done that with this. Write it, don't post it, wait 24 hours and think, because it came off as very entitled. And I thought, you had choices. You chose this job. I'm sure that before you agreed to the job, you knew what the income was going to be, what you would be paid for said job, and that you knew it was in San Francisco, which is one of the most expensive cities in the country to live in. So you knew what you were getting into. And I just don't think it was a smart way to do it, to go out and then call out your CEO and the founder of the company. Well, no, that just isn't very smart. And I wasn't surprised when I read, well, that a couple hours later she was let go from the job for violating a policy. I mean, I think she had an idea of what she wanted to accomplish, and it went horribly awry for her in that it did go viral. It did create a reaction, but probably not the reaction that she wanted.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned she brings up some good points. Livable wage, affordable housing conditions. We'll talk about all of that in a moment. But being a millennial specifically, because she's a millennial, she wrote that letter, and we're all reading it, and people are making assumptions and gauging new perspectives about millennials. And so I want to ask all of you, if you look at the birth years, yes, you're technically all millennials, and at full disclosure, I am too. But do you identify as a millennial? Do you want to be identified as a millennial? How does that word feel to you? Positive, negative? Do you try to stay away from it? Do you embrace it?
I'll jump in and say that insofar as it's viewed negatively and pejoratively, I don't identify with being a millennial. On the other hand, when, there's sort of a feeling of solidarity or even a process, a developmental process where you kind of like gain perspective as you learn things about your generation or connect with other people based on sort of common experiences through, coming of age in similar times. I think that can be great. But it's one of those, I feel like, classic debates among young people kind of grappling with identity. To give you an example, I was with friends over this past New Year's and got into a lively debate about, who's a hipster or who's not a hipster. That's yeah, another sure. classic one. And it's sort of like, it so often degrades into being negative and pejorative, and who wants to identify with that?
Mm-hmm. I'd never given it a lot of thought, really, as to, I guess I'm probably on the older edge of the millennial generation. And I guess what I often just think of my generation as we're the cell phone generation. That's and I am so guilty of it. And how we, you know, we'll look around and you're in a doctor's office, you're in a waiting room, and everyone's on their phone.
You're in line at Wegmans.
Yeah, all the time. And I'm guilty of that. But at the same time, sometimes I'll look and I'll say, geez. You know, Ben and I had a really nice conversation in the lobby. And we just, we were able to sit there and talk. And it almost, you know, there's a point where it's like it becomes somewhat, I think, uncomfortable for my generation to sit and not be able to pull your phone out and look at it. It's like a crutch that we have sometimes. So I think that's what I identify most with our age group, is that we're the cell phone generation. I don't think of myself as a millennial, but part of the cell phone and
device people.
Device generation, absolutely.
I would agree with that. I think I would identify more as part of the cell phone generation versus the millennials. And I just don't feel like I even want to identify with millennials because there's such a negative connotation with it. So I try to avoid that if I can.
I think that there are pieces of it that I would say I identify with. Can you read the positives that you mentioned earlier again? It was
sure.
Good with technology.
Tech savvy, ambitious, confident.
Yes, all those things are great things that I would like to be able to say that they apply to me. I don't, you know, want to be too presumptuous there, but I would say there are also negative aspects that I would also identify with. And much as it isn't my favorite thing to say, I would say that there are points in time where I feel entitled, but that sense of entitlement has also come from watching my parents immediately get jobs right after college. And my father didn't even have a bachelor's degree and immediately got a job. My grandfather retired from Kodak. Like, all of these great things that, you know, we're struggling to find full-time jobs in a field that we actually graduated from, and, you know, jobs that will pay for the food and the living expenses that we're going to have. And so, yes, I feel like that would be amazing to be able to graduate and immediately jump into that field and be able to make that amount of money. But I also know that's not a possibility anymore. And so much as I would like to feel entitled towards that, I recognize that's not.
You bring up a good point, though. We're the product of our families sometimes. And we had a comment come in on Facebook from Lisa, who said, "There are times when I wonder if your parents' birth year influences the way you handle things, too. The expectations that you were raised under cannot be discounted." And she said, "When I was in high school a long time ago, we had to take a class on how to balance your checkbook, pay your bills, live within your means. The biggest flag I get from all of this," meaning Talia's letter, "is that she never learned or considered living within her means and not immediately putting herself in the hole. It kind of goes back to what I meant about the parental influence. If you had the sort of helicopter parent that did everything for you and smoothed over your obstacles, you're not going to know how to operate in the real world. So if you're growing up in a very comfortable environment, you really haven't had to work for much," and I'm not implying that any of you fall into that category, but you haven't had the experience of living in a difficult situation.
I think a lot of what makes each one of us what we are is where you've come from and how you've been raised. And if you have parents that have, I have clients that are very young that are in their late 20s and early 30s that are really doing well for themselves. And that's because it's been ingrained into their minds, is that, you know, save money first. Always try to save something. And there are those that they are successful in that regards. And I know that, you know, my parents will always put in, you have to work hard, and they supported me financially as long as I was working towards something. And they didn't care what it was, but you have to have something to work for. And I think that was something that was ingrained into me, is that you can always work for something. And you may not make a lot of money at it to start, but you have to keep working at it. And for our generation, Jen, you made a good point. You know, we don't come out and go to Kodak for 30 years or Xerox. But what you might have to do is, you know, you might have to come out and work your tail off for 5 or 6 years, and you may have to go work a couple of jobs, and you may have to live with some roommates for a while to get there. But you can. You just have to work a little harder for it.
Mm-hmm. There was a Pew Research Center study earlier this year about generational identity, and it said only 40% of adults aged 18 to 34 consider themselves or identify as millennials. So less than the majority are feeling like they belong in that category. And I wanted to do a little experiment with our Connections intern, Kate Cowie Haskell. We went out on the street and we interviewed some people to see what their perceptions of millennials were. And I'd like to listen to that cut now and then see what all of you think. When you hear the word millennial, what comes to mind?
A young person who is either freshly out of college or about to enter the workforce.
I'm never really sure what that means. I have to look it up every time I see it.
13-year-olds. And I also think of the year 2000, and I also think of those born on the year 2000, and that they're our future.
They're into a bunch of fads and stuff. You know, they pretty much go with the trends and stuff.
Individuals who tend to be very technically skilled, forward in that sense.
You know, they're fun. You know, I'm an old guy, so like I enjoy like the younger people that come to the market. It's great. You know, you get a little energy from them.
What one word would you use to describe a millennial?
Be crazy.
Self-absorbed, probably. Fun-loving. By fun-loving, I mean someone who's really living for the moment rather than ready to buckle down and earn a living and be too concerned about their career or about their retirement or about the future.
Complex.
Energetic, competitive, and very connected to their devices.
So I think we have a mix of positives and negatives in there, which is better than expected, maybe, right?
Yeah, I thought that was fairly positive, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I thought they were just describing human beings, pretty much.
That's a good point. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with you.
How did you feel about when he said crazy?
Well, I mean, come on. I mean, look, let's go to the 70s. Were people crazy in the 70s? Were people who bought pet rocks into fads? You know, what was Woodstock? What was, you know, what were all of these things? What were the flappers in the 20s? Were they crazy? I mean, come on, we all have our crazies. I think when you said Ben, they were describing humans. Yeah, I thought that too. I mean, I can think of people in any age gap who would fit any one of those descriptors.
Yeah, I mean, it's this sort of accusation, the attack on millennials is, I just feel like, unproductive and unwarranted, really, because it's not like narcissists haven't been around. I mean, you can look at Donald Trump today as a great example of a narcissist who's not a millennial. So, I mean, it's sort of what's I kind of ask myself, when especially listening to all those comments, what's the point? Why are we attached to categorizing ourselves and comparing ourselves to other generations? Is that what it's really all about? You know, judging each other. I mean, because you look at these letters and sort of the nature of them on the internet. You know, I think one of the things that's so unfortunate is that it sets up this dynamic where there's an us, there's a them, mm-hmm. there's a judgment, there's a comparison, and it just doesn't feel very healthy or humane, really.
What about in pop culture? Do you see examples of stereotypes of millennials in pop culture that drive you crazy?
Well, I think they just put one on the Fuller House that just came out. In the first episode, they had the two kids. And I think Uncle Joey was trying to get them to talk. And he said, just go in the house and talk to each other. And they both were on their phones. And they said, we're not going in the house. So he picks up the phones and he throws them into the house. And they just follow the phones. And you guys brought up a good point. We are attached to our phones. But what was it? One of the people in the clip there, she said, not ready to buckle down and start a career. And I found that interesting because we're a part of a group of people that does a lot of career hopping. Like, we don't necessarily find our perfect job right away, or we have to, you know, find one position at one company and then move to, you know, the next rung up the ladder to a completely different company. So I think there are that stereotypes out there, but there can be a positive to take away from that.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to play another cut. This one's from Saturday Night Live, and it's a fake TV show they've created called The Millennials. And in this cut, if you haven't seen it, it's of a non-millennial who's been working at this company for quite a while, talking about his success, and then a millennial coming in and just starting there and their interaction together. So let's take a listen to that.
This fall, Fox presents a workplace drama unlike anything you've ever seen.
It took 25 years of work and sacrifice to claw my way to the top of this company. But finally, I'm here.
What? I know you're talking to yourself by the window, but I need a promotion.
I'm sorry, what do you want?
A promotion. And I don't want it. I deserve it.
Why? How long have you even worked here?
3 full days.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Who are you again?
The Millennials.
So, I'm sorry, let me get this straight. You've worked here for 3 days and you expect a promotion?
Yeah, well, nothing crazy. Like, maybe director of communications or digital creative or pictures.
Pictures?
Yeah, I know Photoshop. Now, I'm gonna take a nap. Where's the nap room?
The Millennials, a show that explores what no other dares to. Beautiful 20-somethings trying to find the success and love they're entitled to.
So we're in studio laughing at that, but it's reinforcing some stereotypes that we don't necessarily like, I'm assuming. Everybody's nodding.
Yeah, it just seems to me that sometimes, I guess what I'm envisioning there is, you know, going to take a nap. There's, you know, we think of what goes on in Silicon Valley and places like Google and Facebook, where they do have a non-traditional office. And there are, you know, rooms where people can go play games or things to help bring out their creativity. I found it very, very, very funny. I'm sure there's some basis there, but it just kind of made me shake my head.
Anyone else want to weigh in? Pop culture cultural stereotypes.
I mean, I think the pop culture thing is really a big factor in the discussion, because I find usually that people kind of make their assessments based on those sorts of things, like pop cultural tastes, what you dress like, what you're interested in, how you portray yourself, how you talk. Which is not the same thing as who you are. And so, you know, when someone was talking about the complexity of millennials, I mean, it just speaks to the complexity of people. So we're quick. It's sort of a cultural phenomenon in that sense that we jump to conclusions, this classic judging a book by its cover sort of thing. That's what I think about. And it's, you know, the real interesting people out there, as far as like, there's, you look like at someone like Tavi Gavison, right, who's like this young woman who's very young, like prototypical millennial, commenting on fashion and culture, and you know, she could practically be viewed as like a public intellectual, and is finding connections that are meaningful between, say, like what movie is good and abortion, which is really fascinating. Those who can kind of draw the lines in our culture and have a more meaningful conversation by talking about what's at stake, what are the conflicts, you know, but there's also the hilarity and absurdity of these kind of surface level observations too.
In a way, it might be a good thing, because it brings those stereotypes to light, and we can have a conversation like this that maybe we wouldn't necessarily otherwise. And that's something about the letter, too, is even though it does raise some concerns, we're here in Rochester talking about this letter. Mm-hmm. We're having a conversation about perceptions of millennials. She probably never expected something like this to happen, for it to be the talk of the town for a while. But it's important. And there were some issues in that letter, I think, that she was praised for, because she brought up not making enough money, this livable wage idea. We had a lot of comments come in on Facebook and through email about that, and we can talk about that in our second half hour. I'd like to get to a short break just so we can make sure we get all of your calls, and the phones are starting to light up. We're talking about millennials, perceptions and stereotypes of millennials this hour on Connections. You can join the conversation by calling 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. We're going to take a short break and we'll come right back with your questions.
I'm Evan Dawson. Coming up in our second hour, we'll welcome Tony and Renee Colon of Fuego Coffee Roasters in Rochester. They are an unlikely success story on many levels. Surviving a near-personal tragedy, struggles with college, education, and eventually building a successful business. We'll talk about how they've done it and what they plan to do next hour.
This is WXXI AM Rochester, WRUR FM and HD Rochester, WEOS FM and HD Geneva, and WXXI FM HD2 Rochester.
Disney's latest female lead is not a princess.
Officer Hobbs, I am in pursuit! Woo, woo!
She's a bunny rabbit who's also a cop.
Being tough and being girly and kind are like mutually exclusive ideas, and Disney, I feel like, threw that out the window.
Actress Jennifer Goodwin on her role in the animated movie Zootopia. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on your NPR News station.
Welcome back to Connections. We're talking about millennials this hour, perceptions and stereotypes. And this conversation came about after we read a letter written by a 25-year-old woman in San Francisco who publicly shamed the CEO of the company for which she was working at the time, which was Yelp. Needless to say, she was fired. But the letter has generated a lot of interesting conversations, and that's one we're having today. And we were just talking during the break. We have two of our guests who have experience in the mental health field. And so I'd like to turn it over to Ben and Bianca to talk about how they're seeing this conversation through the lens of their expertise.
Over break, I was just talking about how, one of the things there's a tragedy here, and there's a lot of suffering going on, and that comes out in this letter, sort of in a facetious way in certain respects, certain in a critical way, but also with legitimate issues. I mean, at one point she's talking about, so here I am, 25 years old, balancing all sorts of debt and trying to pave a life for myself that doesn't involve crying in the bathtub every week. Now, you know, you can look at that in the context of this letter and the viral, like all that viral context, and just have no sympathy, have no empathy. Or you can look at a reality, which is that tons of young people are struggling with depression, with anxiety, related to all these issues and the high demands and the pressure. So we were saying a little bit during break that there's, my heart kind of goes out in a way wanting to help these people and find better outlets than, kind of putting yourself on the altar, so to speak, and just letting the, waves roll in.
I agree that mental health does definitely need to be addressed with her situation. I think that's just a very important component to address in anyone's life. But when I was reading her article, I did think of some of the people that I'm working with, and I work with a very high need population. And the way she was just complaining about her living wage, or her lack of living wage, I guess, and the struggle she was going through, I just kind of felt like she really didn't have anything to complain about, because I know so many people that would be so happy to be living off of what she had, and they're trying to get to that point. And it just kind of further upset me with her article, because I was like, okay, I understand that this is hard for you. However, you are not at the lowest of the low right now, and you're trying to say you are.
Mm-hmm. I don't think she ever directly states that she's poor or that she's living in poverty, but she definitely implies that. And we've had so many conversations on the show about poverty, what true poverty is. We're in the midst of an anti-poverty initiative in Rochester. We're seeing things that people are living in very difficult situations. So to look at something like this, someone who has a great education, she has a job, she has a place to live, I think some of the feedback that we've been getting reflects that. People are frustrated because here's someone that has come from relative privilege, in if you were to compare it with someone living in true poverty, and they're complaining. So yes, everyone lives in their own, sees things through their own lens, but sometimes it's hard not to get frustrated.
Well, get frustrated because she has choices.
Right.
That's the, that was to me the most, the hardest thing about this letter to, not the hardest, but the thing that was most frustrating is that you have choices. You can, you could go get another job. And you know what? That may be hard and that may make you more tired. You may lose sleep. You may not be able to spend as much time on Facebook or Twitter. And you may have to make some sacrifices, but you can if you want to. Or you can write a letter to your CEO and you can put it on the internet. But you have choices. And there was a story on the Today Show today. It was a homeless man, I can't remember where, and he wasn't panhandling, he wasn't asking for money, but he was asking people to take his resume. And I thought it really dovetailed well with coming in here today, but I thought that's so cool. He's trying. I mean, this is somebody sitting on the sidewalk and he was outside of a place where they let him sit because he would push carts in the parking lot for free. And he ended up getting hired. He was a cook, and he got hired. A restaurant hired him, so there was a happy ending there. But I thought, you know what? Good for you. You're trying. Mm-hmm. And that's it. We can try. We can make that choice. And that's what I found to be most frustrating about her letter.
Well, as a financial advisor, you were probably frustrated by some of the numbers you may have seen and the choices she made financially. For those that haven't read the letter, this is a brief description. She says, I got paid yesterday $733.24 biweekly, but I have to save as much of that as possible to pay my rent, which is $1,245. Remember, she's in San Francisco, for my apartment that's 30 miles away from work because it was the cheapest place I could find that had access to the train, which cost me $5.65 one way to get to work. That's $11.30 a day, by the way. I make $8.15 an hour after taxes. I also have to pay my gas and electric bill. Last month, it was $120. She says I spent 80% of my income toward rent.
That's tough. That's hard. And that's the other part of that is that it's, you live in a place that's very expensive. And it sounds like she's not living in the metro in San Francisco if she's 30 miles out of the town, but California is an expensive state to live in. New York is an expensive state to live in. You know, I feel for her, but in that regard, but you knew that going in.
Can I jump in here too?
Absolutely.
I had to skip a few paragraphs of the letter just because I got so angry, and I think it was right about that point that I just couldn't keep reading, and I went immediately to the end. So correct me if I'm wrong here, but I didn't mention anything about having roommates, and that was the first thing that I thought of when I first moved out of my mother's house. I moved into an apartment on Pearl Street that I saw on Craigslist. I paid $240 for a room monthly that was roughly the size of a closet, and I lived with three people that I'd never met before. I'm not saying that's the smartest decision. Like, you don't need to make all of your decisions based on what you find on Craigslist, but I think that was another issue that she didn't even consider. She didn't have to get an apartment 30 miles out of the city. She didn't have to live by herself. I feel like she's asking for sympathy because she wanted, like in the first sentence you read, she wanted something like a credit card or a pager. She wanted her own apartment, which is very admirable, but she didn't have that. And to spend $10 a day transporting herself just to work on the salary that she's making was ridiculous.
And just because you want something doesn't mean you need to have it at that moment. I mean, that is, you know, when we talk with people about saving is, you know, save some money for something. I mean, save some money for your retirement, but we also like to see it. Save for something you want. And maybe that's a house. Maybe that's your own apartment that you can have. The idea is, you know, maybe that would have better manifested itself in her life as a goal. And not something that you have right now is, you know what, I want to be out on my own. I don't want to have roommates, but I need to for a while. And maybe she could save up some money then to make that a more realistic possibility.
Here's a comment from Brooke on Facebook. She says, in theory, I'm on Talia's side as I believe companies should be responsible for paying their employees not just a minimum wage, but a living wage that allows them to afford the city in which they live and work. However, I also thought she came across as an entitled brat who felt she was above the work she was doing, not to mention that she complains about having to put in 1 year of customer service work before moving to a quote-unquote better job. But the response, which cited her ambivalence to work, suggested that bootstrapping is all it takes to get ahead in this society, and that's simply not the case anymore. It's easier for some people than it is for others, and that's just a fact. And that's a good point. It's true. It is easier for some than it is for others. I see you all nodding. There's some hesitation. Thoughts?
Well, that's that old adage, too, that comes down to who you know, right? I got a great position in the field that I'm studying right now because someone I know knew someone who worked at that facility, and then I got a job at that facility, and then I got promoted at that facility, and I never would have had that opportunity if it hadn't been due to someone I know. Granted, I could have submitted my resume and done that and worked hard, but the same thing could have happened here. I could have been told, oh, you have to work at the bare minimum being an intern for a year before you ever exceed being an intern.
Mm-hmm. It is. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Ben.
Well, you know, maybe we could touch on one of the common complaints about millennials being sort of this related to entitlement, not paying dues, right? And I think that one of the things that really bothered people here is that, you know, she didn't seem willing to pay dues, and that's you know, sort of kind of a reality that most people kind of accept and or believe in. But, you know, one thing that I keep thinking about in this conversation is, you know, how we're making massive assumptions about this person. We really don't know that much about her.
That's a very good point.
And on top of that, you know, I still think it's sort of lamentable that, you know, that this is even public in the first place. Like, the tragedy is that again, I think it was stupid of her to do this. Just frankly, it was kind of dumb. But then it's tragic. But what's also tragic is how we use it to criticize this individual and criticize what we're describing, like her as a representation. And it's just loaded with problems as we get into that thing. Like, to me, you got to think, like, the issues she's talking about are also real and super disconcerting, like how San Francisco, how major metropolitan areas are transforming into highly gentrified, extremely expensive places where people living, you know, an hour commute away can't afford to work, and yet we're all flocking to these major cities.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and oftentimes you're coming out of college with a massive amount of debt, and you're competing with other people who may have graduated after you, whose skills may look more fresh. So maybe you're not as much as a viable candidate as you were before. So it's difficult. I don't mean to discount what she's saying in terms of that. It looks like the phone's starting to line up. Let's start taking some calls. First up is John in Rochester. Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi. Do you have a question or comment about millennials?
Yes. I've had a lot of experience with them in my personal life, and I'm 45, and in my work life, and I think they're exactly like people have always been who are that age. I think the only thing that might be disconcerting to some people that are older, their communication style, you know, the way they use language or the way their voice sounds or the way they choose to structure sentences or just the way that sometimes they present themselves, but I think it's the same as anyone in their 20s or early 30s has always been. I haven't really noticed a big difference between them and myself when I was their age.
Thanks, John. Thank you. That's a great point.
Chuck, John, yeah, I really, towards the end of what you were saying, John, it made sense, is that I think back to who was I when I was 20 or 21, and I talked a different way and acted a different way and carried myself a different way. It is a good point. Part of that is maturing. And, you know, that's a wide generation. I mean, so it goes from people who were born in the 90s and the 80s. I mean, you're talking about people who could be 15 or 16 and someone who could be 31 or 32. It's a big, it's a big difference, and there's a lot of maturing. And I think some of the greatest maturing as adults happens during that time. So great point that you made there at the end, John, about how there's just people growing up still.
Jen, did you want to weigh in on that?
I thought it was interesting that you mentioned language. That's something that's brought up a lot, too, that younger individuals or those who are still in college or millennials have an interesting speech pattern. I noticed it a little bit with Bianca earlier, and I think it's just become a language filler for us to say like, so, as, and just as people before us have had their own idiosyncrasies with the way they speak and the way they communicate with others who are in the same peer group. And I think that, you know, given a more professional context, that's not necessarily the case.
That's very true. Communication language evolves. We're all responding to society around us. There's a comment that came in via email that I'd like to share. This is from CJ. He says he's a baby boomer, but he's raised millennials. They get a bum rap, he says. We expect them to conduct themselves on a level of Lincoln, but offer presidential debates that would shock a schoolyard. Of those with whom I deal with, kids, coworkers, etc., I'm impressed with all their commitment, hard work, and creativity. I know the burden of school debt can be crushing, and compared to my own life, it does not seem at all fair. I had the luxury of a hobby job out of college and could easily live in D.C. on $12,000 a year. Who can work a fun job and live now? It's a good question. We've let this generation down. They focus almost entirely on career and worries. How many people do you know who plan to have children? Not a lot of hope for the future. So thank you, CJ, for that comment.
That's really sad.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. But it's looking at it through the perspective of how things have changed.
I think sometimes, too, and what CJ's comment about, you know, he doesn't see this generation as that way. He sees hardworking people, too, is that, you know, we have the internet, and a great example was Bruce Springsteen played a concert here the other night, and I'm looking on Facebook on Sunday thinking, my gosh, everyone was at this concert. I was, you know, we didn't go, but everyone was there. And then I realized, no, it was six or seven of my friends that all posted pictures around the same time. So I all of a sudden thought everyone was there. And I think with Twitter and Facebook and a letter like this is that there's sort of a mob mentality that comes up very quickly as you see everyone's talking about this. Well, yeah, a lot of people talked about it, but there's also probably a lot of people who have no idea what happened. And I think our generation is somewhat representative of that, is that, yes, there are some people that are entitled that feel that way. There's some people that are self-absorbed. And there's some people, and I think the five of us in this room, that people that work hard, that have goals, that are really trying to better their lives. And that's something that I think has spread across generations.
Mm-hmm. Caleb on Twitter says, he's talking about implied connotations of millennial often say more about the person using it and their objectives than anything else, which is an interesting point as well. The phones are lighting up again. Let's see. It looks like we have Ryan in Geneva. Hi, Ryan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am a Gen Xer who owns his own company, and I employ a lot of millennials. And I generally find them to be hardworking, and there is level of entitlement that still exists there. But I think the way I look at it is it's entitlement for the right things. I think that a living wage shouldn't be an entitlement. I mean, it should just be something that we strive for a healthy economic society. And so I think what unfortunately is getting lost here is some judgment on the generation that's trying to convey a message, which I think is the correct one, that we do have an income inequality, and it's manifesting itself in these ways.
Thank you, Ryan. Everyone's nodding. Everyone's agreeing.
Yeah, and you know, what Ryan was saying starts to open up a whole nother debate about income equality, and we could take another hour talking about that. And it is true that, you know, it's tough for, I'm assuming, you know, Ryan's a business owner. It's probably a small business owner, a local business owner. It's tough to compete with larger corporations that do work overseas, that have lower costs. It's tougher for smaller businesses who employ so many people to survive and to keep wages where I'm sure business owners would like to pay their employees more than they can, but you have to pay them what you can afford to pay them, not what you would like to pay them. Otherwise, the business isn't going to survive.
Mm-hmm. I came across a monster.com article when I was preparing for the show, and it had a list of stereotypes that companies see in millennials, and then they offered advice as to how to prove them wrong. And one of them was job hopping. We haven't really talked about that too much, but Jen, you brought it up earlier. It says, younger workers change jobs more frequently. A 2012 PayScale report found that the median tenure for a millennial employee was 2 years compared to 7 years for a baby boomer. There's a reason. Millennials move around a lot more. That's often what they need to do to get promoted or to make more money. So it's not necessarily because they're unhappy or they're looking for to leave opportunities that they might not find interesting or supported in, but everyone has to better themselves, and it seems that Monster.com is saying to prove them wrong, stay in an organization for at least 1 year, but then feel free to move on if it benefits you.
I think that's really valid, and it's, you know, our parents, my parents, my in-laws, they worked one job for 30, for 40 years, and then they retired. It's different now. A lot of those, the Kodaks, the Xeroxes, you know, they don't, not a lot of people. Here in Rochester, those are examples where people come out of college, you go to work, 30 years later, you've been there your whole career. It's different. It's harder to find. Some places you can't move up, so you have to go somewhere else. And I think that's something that's really great for people to do, that if you can't find what you're looking for, you can go somewhere else and try to find it, and we should.
Mm-hmm. We did a show about a month ago on ageism, and we were focusing on senior citizens at the time, but when we were preparing for the show, we had a lot of comments come in about there's ageism for young people too. They don't feel respected. They don't feel like their ideas are taken into account sometimes because they're not viewed as seasoned sometimes. Any thoughts about ageism? Have you, any of you experienced that at work?
Not so much, really.
I'll jump in. I work at a long-term care facility in Rochester, and so my job, I deal obviously with individuals who have moved to a long-term care facility, and also those who are a little bit older than me, maybe have been in that job a little bit longer, who are, you know, nurses, doctors, that kind of thing, and I'm not too much behind them in age. I'm 26. I don't know about you guys, but I've been told a lot that I don't look like I'm 26. I look like I'm much younger. And so I get a lot of attitude from individuals when I don't necessarily agree with how they want to go about a certain task, or when I just ask questions about, oh, you wanted to do it this way, you noted it this way, why? Can you explain it to me? I want to make sure that we're doing what's best for those who we're caring for. And I've gotten some attitude along the lines of, you don't know what you're talking about, I'm more educated than you. And obviously from a doctor's standpoint, yes, that's true. From, you know, other individuals who maybe work in a variety of different jobs, I might have more education than them. I don't necessarily have the same job experience, but that I feel like I get discounted simply because I look younger, I look less seasoned than anybody else.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else feel...
I don't feel like I've experienced that myself. I'm one of the younger workers at my job right now, but we have, our job is all that we're case managers, and our goal is to help our clients reach their goal. And I just feel like my supervisors have equal respect for me as they do my other coworkers. I've never felt that I've been discriminated against for my age, and I'm honestly not even sure if anyone at work knows my age, but I don't think I've experienced that yet.
There have been a few times, and it's more, I think it's more based on experience, where there's a, you know, somebody's come in and we've talked about, you know, managing, helping them manage their money. And there was one gentleman who did, he called and said, you know, I just don't think you have enough experience. I think you're too young, so I'm gonna go a different direction. I said, okay, you know, you can do that. It's a big decision. But for every one of those, there's a lot of people that say, I like that you're younger. I like that I know, can think you're probably going to be here for 15, 20, 30 years because, you know, I'm still going to be here and I want some continuity there. So it's been rare that it's happened, but it has, and you know, that's part of the deal.
We're down to about our last minute or so. I'd like to go around the panel one more time. Anything that struck you in the letter that was a major takeaway that changed how you think about millennials or how you interact with your fellow millennials? Was there one piece of the letter that really struck you?
One thing that I really noticed, and I guess this is coming from my nutrition standpoint, she talks a little bit about how she chose to eat meals from a 10-pound bag of rice. So she had rice for dinner every day. And I know that we've talked a lot in different classes I've taken about knowing what your resources are and knowing where you can get additional food. And I think that just if you're struggling making a minimum wage, take that into account.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else? Quick thoughts?
My hope for her is that this doesn't jeopardize her future in terms of employment, in terms of her career. She's young. I hope that this doesn't hold her back from finding success and happiness later on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'll just say, too, that, you know, life is long and it's, you know, about experience, and we can develop and change over a long period of time. So
I'd like to thank my guests for the hour, Bianca Bishop, Ben Eskind, Jen Everdyke, and Chuck Wade, all millennials joining me here today. John Andrus is helping us out engineering this program. Thank you, John. Kate Cowie Haskell was our intern for today. Thank you, Kate. Evan Dawson will be back with you on Monday. Thank you for listening to Member Supported Public Radio.